Lance from Alcoholic.
I saw Doug when Doug walked in, and he knew I was introducing him tonight. And the first thing he says was, "You're severely underdressed for introducing me." That's kind of the way it rolls with Doug. Doug takes this very, very seriously. And he doesn't care what I or most everybody else thinks of Doug, but he lays it out for you. He's a guy that when I don't get my sponsor on the phone, Doug's the next call. And most of the time I listen to what we talk about there. It's been a couple of times we had to revisit some stuff, but God puts people in your life that help you out if you're open enough to receive that help. And Doug's definitely one of those guys, and I'm thankful that he's moved here from Texas permanently, and very appreciative of that, and happy to hear what he's got to share tonight.
Thank you, Lance. My name is Doug Mefford. I am an alcoholic.
Hey, Doug.
Thanks to the grace of a loving God, the 12 steps, and strong sponsorship, I haven't had the occasion to take a drink since August 15th of 1994, and I'm extremely thankful for that period of sobriety tonight. And Jerry, I want to thank you for inviting me to come over and share with you. It's always an honor and a privilege to get an opportunity to participate in my recovery. I used to say it was a special honor to stand behind one of these podiums, but the reality is I just want to serve Alcoholics Anonymous the way it served me. And I don't know that I'll ever be capable of doing so, because what Alcoholics Anonymous has done in my life is really amazing in so many ways. And my only hope tonight is that whatever version of my story, whatever parts God deems necessary for me to share with you tonight, that my enthusiasm, appreciation, and gratitude for Alcoholics Anonymous and its role and effect on my life come through, because it's immense, quite honestly. It's very immense. I've got a couple of good friends of mine here from Texas that are over on a not-so-pleasant visit. Tomorrow we got to make a little road trip to see somebody that's not doing too well. And the fact of the matter is that man's celebrating 43 years of continuous sobriety today. And I can tell you that there's been a large impact made on this alcoholic's life over the 18 years I've had the occasion to know him. And he's in bad health, but the impact and the legacy that we leave in Alcoholics Anonymous is generally long and wide if we're a committed participant in our own recovery. You know, and the Atlanta Roundup, Sharon came and talked, and she talks often about the ripples in the pond. You know, when the rock goes in, the ripples are created. And many times in our lives in sobriety, we don't get to see where the ripples hit the shore. And sometimes we are just so fortunately blessed to watch that ripple come to shore. And that's what I think the book talks about when it talks about, you know, in working with others, that working with others and the experience that it is something that we are sure you will not want to miss. And when you get the opportunity to work with other alcoholics and you watch their life change and you watch them still help other people, you get to see the ripples come ashore, and it really enhances life in so many ways. You know, I came here as a young guy, 22 years old, as a byproduct of alcoholism. You know, I was born into a very loving and nurturing, close-knit family that I didn't want for much. I didn't need anything. And I had a great example in my parents of how to live life based on principle and do the next right thing that's in front of you to do. You know, my dad went to work every day. My mom stayed home and cooked dinner for us, and we sat down at the kitchen table as a family every night, and we had what would be the traditional, quote-unquote, normal family. And the life I had was really good, is my earliest memories. And at some point early in my life, and I don't know why, or there wasn't a given circumstance, but fear entered my life. And when fear entered my life, what happened is I started to withdraw from life and started to withdraw to within myself. And I started looking at you, and I didn't quite feel like I fit with you. Because what you looked like and the way you carried yourself and the way you expressed yourself was different than the way I felt inside. And I couldn't really put my finger on that. But what it did is it made me continue to retreat further inside of self. Now, I couldn't have told you that then. It took a long time and a lot of work to discover that fact and truth about my life going as far back as I could remember. As a result of being driven by fear in many respects, I felt I needed to prove myself. So therefore, what I was a guy that if you told me I couldn't, I kind of had to, you know. If you told me don't, I must. And I kind of went against the grain. I like to do things in order to get away with them. You know, I was a guy that wanted to get away with it. You know, when I was an altar boy in the Catholic Church, they said, don't drink the wine. Well, of course, I've got to drink a little wine. You know, my first taste of alcohol happened at the ripe old age of 4 years old. You know, all I did was beat my dad into submission to give me that Pabst Blue Ribbon beer he was drinking with his friends watching a football game. You know, and what I learned in looking back on my life, even that far back, was at that young age, I didn't want to be the crumb snatching kid. I wanted to be one of the men. I wanted to be somebody else doing something else with someone else, even at that early age. You know, I was never okay just where I was. There was always when this happens, or when that happens, or when I get this, or when I got that, or when this circumstance arises, or whatever. It was always when. I'll be okay when. The reality is, when never came for me. When I held on as long as I could to that when as a young boy, and at 12 years old I had a plan drunk. And that when for me happened right then. Because I actually experienced for the first time in my life the sense of ease and comfort that the doctor's opinion talks about. You know, I don't know about anybody in here, but I can tell you when I read that in the book, the sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a few drinks, it still makes me kind of breathe a little deeper, just kind of like, I know what that feels like, you know, and I know just as much today, 21 years removed from my last drink, that ease and comfort could come today, just like it did 21 years ago. But the reality is it didn't bring me the benefit. That ease and comfort was a place I always wanted to get. But very quickly into my drinking, what happened? If you're an alcoholic of my type, what happened is that ease and comfort became the objective. And what happened most of the time I drank was I overshot the mark in a real quick hurry. You know, ease and comfort became drunken buffoonery really fast, really often. You know, and I didn't become a daily drunk at 12 years old by any stretch. It's kind of hard to get booze at that age. But I drank as often as I could, and every opportunity I had, I drank as much as I could to get that effect. See, I'm a guy that drinks for the effect produced by alcohol. You know, I'm still an effects guy. The funny thing is I'll drink coffee, and I doctor it. I put, you know, cream and sugar, and I got to get it the right color and texture and flavor. And people will give me grief about, you know, coffee snobs will give me a grief about what it tastes like. And, you know, you got to enjoy it. I said, I don't drink coffee for the taste. I drink it purely for the effect produced by coffee, you know. I need some caffeine, you know. I can still do those things in my life today. But I drank all the time that I could, you know. And I didn't grow up in a drinking household. Now, I grew up in a household affected by alcoholism because I've got grandparents that are alcoholic. And I've got a mother that was affected as the oldest of six by alcoholism. And an untreated Al-Anon as a mother and a budding alcoholic growing up allows for there to be a lot of manipulation and enablement. And I took full advantage of that at all given points. You know, I did everything I could to get away with it. I did everything I could to manipulate you to keep you at distance from me if you were questioning me about my drinking. You know, what happened is quickly upon my drinking escalating, the things that had value and the things that I felt important were important in my life started to fall away. And I started to retreat more and more inside myself and go more and more the way of the drinkers. You know, and the family relations, that close bond, you know, talk about, you know, dysfunctional families. I was a big dysfunction in my family in many respects because I just disengaged and they worried about me because there were things that I wasn't willing to participate in that I was previous to my drinking because I didn't really care. You know, the fact that I didn't really care enough for you wasn't because I didn't have a heart. It wasn't because I wasn't raised with values. It wasn't because I wasn't given principles, guidance, and leadership in my life. It was because I unknowingly was suffering from alcoholism. You know, and I don't know where, when, how I crossed the imaginary line. You know, but the book talks about it. It's the most apt description. I think it's in There Is a Solution. It says in the beginning of that chapter, if when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if once you start drinking, you have little control over the amount you take, then you're probably alcoholic. Now, I can assure you, the first part of that never applied to me even when I came to you. I never honestly wanted to stop drinking. I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous wanting to stop drinking, I can assure you. At 22 years old, that was not anywhere on my radar other than a temporary respite to get the heat off, quite honestly, you know, and get a little bit of settlement, and then I could go forward. You know, fortunately, I caught alcoholism sitting in the rooms of AA, and I've not had to pick up a secondary white chip since my first meeting, you know, because relapse is not a requirement to gain long-term sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. I hear it all the time in meetings. I relapsed. I got another. I want to reestablish, and I'm grateful for those that get the opportunity to reestablish, you know, but I'm not a guy that says it's okay to go pick up a drink after you've been here. It's not. If you suffer from alcoholism, going picking up a drink is likely a death wish. That's my experience, and I've watched enough and buried enough alcoholics that decided they couldn't stay here with us in the time that I've been here. And if you stay here and you stay committed and you stay participatory and you engage in those people's lives, you know what? you're going to see a little bit of your heart get ripped out and your life on this road of recovery. Because alcoholism is a hideous disease that kills people, plain and simple. There's no middle ground for me. So needless to say, I'm in high school, I'm playing sports and drinking, and those are my two reliefs from this head and this life. And my drinking's getting more and more and more. My studies are going less and less and less, and my athletics are the other place in which that I fit in or I belong. That's one of the only two places that I could get the quietness between my head was when I was on the athletic field and engaged in that activity, or drunk enough to quiet the mind. When I graduated high school, I was probably, I was a little immature. I was 17 when I graduated high school. I was kind of a mama's boy, and I was playing baseball, and I decided I wanted to go to the junior college and pursue my career and furtherment of my education playing baseball. So I went to the junior college, and I started playing ball. You know, and what was cool about that is I didn't even need to leave my house or leave my town. I just went to a new place in the junior college and became a new person. You know, I don't know anybody that is like we are. Every time we relocate, our circumstances, situation, or or geographically, we become somebody new, if you're like me anyway. You know, it was a fresh start. It's a new place. It's a new way. I can give them everything I want them to see. Now, I didn't know who I was because I had lived my life to this point, in many respects, being what I thought it was that you thought I should be in order to be to be with you. Now, that's crazy if you think about it, you know, because as a teenager, I think everybody's just ate up with the angst, right? And drinking alleviates that angst. And I lived my life drinking to get the relief of what I was worrying about was what I thought you thought of me. Now, how crazy is that? I think I know what you think of me. And I know that you don't like me because I'm not worthy of being liked. So therefore, I hate you. Now, I've not spoken a word to you. You know, I've just seen you. And I know that I hate you and everything about you just for the simple fact that you don't like me. Because you can't. And the reality is I didn't think anybody could like me because I didn't like me. I don't know why. There's no definitive thing or event or circumstances that led to that, but I wasn't comfortable with me. I didn't like who I was. So anyway, I went to the junior college, became the new guy that I needed to become, and met my new best friends on the baseball team. And we started drinking and having fun, and I'm the starting catcher for the Waubonsie Community College Fighting Chiefs, and things are going well. And I've got the opportunity to gain some scholarships to a four-year university, a little D2 four-year university to get my education paid for. And me and Chris and Jeff, my two new best friends on the baseball team, had a little business idea. We started a little distribution venture, and we were making a little money, doing well with that, and so on. But the funny thing is those kind of things become a little more public than they should be in a small community college environment. And the coach caught wind of our little business venture, and he decided he needed to talk to Chris and Jeff and I. And that was presented to me when I was in the library on the first day of the second semester of my second year of eligibility while I was going to get this scholarship and all of these things that were going on good in baseball. And the immediate committee adjoined in my head. And they started talking amongst themselves about what story I had to tell in order to get away with it. Because here's the thing, what I had learned is if you give me the opportunity to look you dead in the eye and bald-faced lie, I can sell you whatever story I want to. And as soon as you start to do this, I know I've hooked you. You know, the reality is when you nod at what I say, it's the truth, whether there's any validity to what I'm saying or not. Because, you know, why would you ever let the truth get in the way of a good story? You know, and I can spin a good story and I can make it about everybody else and never about me. You know, I was that guy that was the rubber guy. I could always bounce it off. But needless to say, we sat down, the coach and I started talking, and he basically said, "You can't play for me." And I thought, "You don't understand the decision you're making, coach. I'm the captain of the field, you know. I'm the commander in chief on the field. I'm the only one that's doing this. I'm your starting catcher. You're going to be awful without me." You know, but I couldn't say those things because the reality is I'm a coward. I'm afraid to express myself. I'm that guy, you know, and I don't know if there's any other guys or maybe even gals that, you know, are great fighters in your own mind. You know, you have an argument with somebody or a confrontation and you leave that confrontation and you just romanticize about how you just beat the life out of that guy, you know, or whatever the case is. That was me, you know. I had fights after the fact in my mind all the time. I won every one of them, you know, but I was a coward. I'd never fight, you know. I was scared, you know. I was scared, but I was, I'm not going to show you I'm scared. So I'd talk and talk and talk, and then somebody'd hit me and I'd go crying home, you know. That kind of stuff is what happened because I wasn't a guy that wanted to fight. So coach and I are talking for a while, and you know, I've been playing baseball now for 12 years of my life, had a future, given literally blood, sweat, and tears, broken bones to the sport. And the coach basically says to me, he says, "Do you want to play baseball?" And I said, "Absolutely, I'm passionate for the game, and I believe I have a future in it." He says, "I believe you have a future in it as well, but you have to do a few things." And one of the things I was to do was arrange a meeting between he and my parents. And really, baseball wasn't that important. I didn't have much of a future in it. I really didn't want to give anything to it. So I decided that, yeah, no thanks. Because I wasn't going to let him tear down the web of deceit that I'd built. You know, I'm living the double life and getting away with it pretty well, and I don't know exactly what he knows, and there's no way I'm going to let him divulge that to my parents and break that barrier. No, we're not going to do that, so I just quit. You know, because I don't care about anything more than I care about my drinking and my lifestyle. Now, I couldn't have told you that day that I was making an alcoholic decision, but that was the first conscious, truly conscious alcoholic decision I made. Because I put something of value, purpose, and meaning aside in order to continue drinking and using drugs, the things that I did, period. Because those things mattered more. I went home and my drinking took off, and it was really the beginning of the end. Over the next 2 years plus, I became, in essence, a daily drinker. You know, I went away to the university in the fall because my parents paid for it. After I got my associate's degree, I had the parental scholarship program. I didn't need a baseball scholarship. And I went away to university and became a daily drinker. I went to class sparingly, and I partied, and my drinking became an absolute necessity in my life. My first grade point average at university when I went away from school was 0.75. Wasn't very good. You know, second semester I attended class and got a 3.5. You know, got off of probation because I didn't want to get kicked out of the best party I'd been in forever. You know, third semester, same as the first. Fourth semester, it's a little too much for me to handle. You know, I'm 6 weeks in, and I'm realizing I got a 15-hour or 12-hour class load. I got to be in the classroom 10 hours a week. That's a lot of commitment for a guy like me. You know, 10 hours a week is asking a little bit much, quite honestly. I just don't think I can do that, you know. I mean, that interferes with what I'm doing because all I'm doing at this point is drinking to live and living to drink. You know, by this time, my sister and I, who were referred to as soulmates when I was in high school, are no longer engaged in any sort of a relationship because she says to me, I don't like you when you're like that. And that is some state of inebriation, therefore I can't go around her anymore to borrow money or see her or whatever. She was tired of my stealing ways and my drinking ways and the way I was doing things. So I just disengaged because that's what I do. If you confront me, you question me, you look at me, what do? I lash out in anger to try and get you to back off. I pull on your heartstrings to manipulate you and get my way. Or if that doesn't work, I just say, forget you. I don't need you anyway. Because the thing is I don't need anybody that I can't use. That's the real root, the real truth of how I was living my life at that point. If I can't get something from you, if I can't take something from you, if I can't further my agenda, whatever that may be, on your expense, I don't want, need, or have any use for you in my life. And that's the way I'm living. Now, so I go around to all the university professors and I tell them I've got to quit school because I'd ask him for a W so that my stellar reputation as a student wouldn't be tarnished. And, you know, I told them all that, you know, I got my girlfriend pregnant, so I have to go to work. Now, I didn't have a girlfriend, but, you know, that was a good story for me, you know. So that was what I tried to do. And it didn't matter because I didn't care. That's the truth. I didn't care. Long about this time, they start having meetings about me. Now, I don't know if anybody's been invited to participate or, you know, be in attendance at meetings where you're the object of conversation, but you do not get an opportunity to participate. If you've been there, you know what that's like. And that's what was going on in my world. Command performance, sit down. We are going to assess you. It's kind of like your sponsor giving you your inventory, you know. And there's a collective of them now giving me my inventory. And I don't get to respond. I don't get to defend myself. And they're talking about, like, what are we going to do about him? I'm sitting right here, you know. What are we going to do about it? What are we going to do about that? I'm no longer the loving youngest son, Douglas. I'm him, it, and that, and they don't know what to do with me, you know, quite frankly. And along about this time, my aunt comes and talks to my mom. Now, my aunt's the youngest of the six and used to spend time with us when she was in college. And she decides, you know what? Doug can come stay with me in Nashville. And they offer me that opportunity. I said, well, great. If I can just get away from those losers at Northern Illinois University that are dragging me down from my potential, that are stopping me from reaching the goals and heights that, of course, I'm going to attain. If I can just get away from them and those losers, I will rock it on to the potential of my life. Because I've been told my life, you're a smart kid. You got lots of abilities. You can do anything you want. You can be anything you want. You've got the potential to do anything. You know, it took a good sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous when I was new sober to teach me what potential meant. My first sponsor said, yeah, you talk about all this potential, Doug, but you know what potential is? I said, what is it, Darryl? He said, potential just means you hadn't done anything yet. And how absolutely true that was. Because what I was a guy driven by fear. And the reality is, the reality of my fear was I was so deathly afraid of failure because of what I was so consumed with, what you thought of me, I couldn't fail. And so what I would do, driven by that fear, is settle for less than what God had in store for me. Because ultimately, if I reached for the goal that God had in store, I would succeed beyond my ability to maintain, and ultimately I would fail. And that fear of failure kept me settling for less and less and less and less, to the point in which that I wasn't doing anything. So I went down to Nashville, stayed with my Aunt Liz, my Uncle Jim. It was a setup. She was a certified drug and alcohol counselor. And they sent me to work with my Uncle Jim at Nashville Wine and Spirits. So I was working at a liquor store and being assessed by my aunt living in their house. I can tell you, when I crossed the threshold of Nashville Wine and Spirits, a fine wine shop in Nashville in the uptown area over there, not far from Vanderbilt University, that's selling wine to the high society folks of Nashville. The Southern Society ladies buying $500 and $600 bottles of wine. When I crossed the threshold of that wine shop, I can assure you, I had never touched any wine that had ever seen a grape. You know, because Mad Dog, Thunderbird, Night Train, that kind of stuff doesn't come from grapes. That's manufactured. And that's my drink of choice when I can't get anything that I really want. But now I got to sell this fine wine. You know, I don't know if there's any winos. I mean, I was a wino. These are wine drinkers I'm selling it to. But, you know, they're wanting to basically understand the floral effervescence and the fruity concoction and the tannin, how it works in your palate with this food and blah, blah, blah. Jerry's nodding his head. He obviously was a wine drinker. He understands those things I'm saying. And I can tell you, I immediately became a wine salesman when I walked across the threshold, because I can listen to what you say and I can put my own spin on it and work well. You know, I'm a wordsmith. I can twist it around. I can be a wine salesman. See, my ego won't let me tell you that I don't know something. I know everything there is to know about everything there is to know about anything. Just ask me. That's the way I'm living my life, because I'm so insecure and I can't ask for help and I can't say I don't know. Driven by fear. We go to a wine tasting. We had to sell a new line. And this is an example of the alcoholic ego and the inability, utter inability, to ask for help. I'm sitting in this wine tasting. There's five of us. I sit in the middle so I can observe my surroundings, because I've got to fit in, because I'm an expert at what I'm doing here. They pull the cork out of the bottle and they pass it down. Everybody smells the wine. They start describing it. I smell it. I describe it with a little change in what they said. Now, I can't tell you what I said. I smelled cork, you know, but I can't say that I just smelled cork. I got to describe what they describe. Then they pour a little wine in everybody's glass and everybody picks it up and starts to swirl it. It's got to breathe, you know. If it doesn't breathe, it can't taste right. If it doesn't taste right, you can't describe it right. If you can't describe it right, you can't sell it right. So it's breathing wine, it's breathing, 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 everybody's breathing, and everybody picks it up, takes a big swirl. They're swishing, I'm swishing, everybody's swishing. I've used mouthwash, I know how to swish. That damnedest thing I ever saw happen my whole life happened. Two down, this guy picks up this paper bucket and he spits out the wine, and I'm thinking, oh God, they're going to know I don't know what I'm doing. I've already swallowed the wine. I don't understand why you would ever spit out perfectly good alcohol. That's alcohol abuse. I mean, seriously. I got alcohol in my mouth. You expect me to spit it out so I can tell you how it tastes? I don't give a damn how it tastes. I want to know what it's going to do to me, right? So what happens? They give me the bucket. I got to puff my cheeks out, and I'm swishing air. You know, exaggerated spitting of an empty mouth into the bucket, because I can't say I already swallowed wine. I can't say that because I'm so driven by fear and insecurity and what you think of me. I'm so driven by what I believe your opinion of me is going to be. I have no ability to just be who I am, where I am, what I am. I start longing to be away from Nashville Wine and Spirits because I didn't fit in there. But I met my new buddy Stan, and we went to the bar. And Stan was a musician in Nashville. We went to the bar and started drinking. Had a couple of drinks, and Stan says, Doug, I got to go. And I'm like, what do you mean? We're drinking. And he said, I drank. I said, yeah, but we're drinking. He said, I drank. I have to go to band practice. I said, Stan, we are drinking. You don't need to go to band practice. We are drinking. He said, Doug, I have drank, and I'm going to band practice. Now, that is a foreign concept to me. I don't associate with people that drink and leave, that have drank. I have drank. Drinking is that. I mean, I'm drinking. That is an activity that is complete and encompassing in every way, shape, and form. Once I start, now I don't know I'm alcoholic. I don't know that I am in full-blown alcoholism, that once I start drinking, I have no control. I don't know this. I am consciously deciding on a daily basis that I am going to drink to the point of blacking out, falling down, puking on myself, and loving every minute of it. and wake up the next morning with the dry heaves, try to suck a little water down, maybe with some urine in my pants, maybe a little vomit on my shirt, who knows what, and convince myself the next morning that I was having a good time. Man, I'm having fun. This drinking is just for me. When in all reality, it's the hideous four horsemen. I hate everything about me and everything about my life and everything about you and everything about all things. And I don't want to be there anymore. Because I'm in Nashville, Tennessee, drinking by myself. I don't have the lower companions. I don't have the people to point the finger at and say, I'm not that bad, but if I get that bad, I'll stop. You just don't understand. I'm living my life, selling my soul, one drink at a time. You walk into the bar and the bartender says, what do you have? I'll have a Budweiser and a shot of Jack Daniels. What'll it cost me? It's going to cost you the love of your life. No problem. Give it to me. Walk into the bar. Bartender, what do you have? Budweiser, Jack and Coke. What's it going to cost me? It's going to cost you the love of your family. Okay. I'll pay that price. See, I don't know that that's what I'm paying when I'm buying those drinks. I don't know the true cost to my life as I'm paying that bartender for that booze. But all I know is I don't long for anything but oblivion. I want to be back with those old friends. My older brother had a baby. I'm deciding to go. 6 weeks I was in Nashville. 6 weeks. I had decided to go back north, and I'm going to recapture a little old fun with those friends. And I stop off in Indianapolis to see the Grateful Dead for 3 days on the way back home. And that leads me to what happened. What happened for me is a series of a long few days. On the second night of that camping trip, I overindulged in a great number of things, including a vast amount of alcohol. And I had a white light near-death experience. And I came out of that a paranoid delusional psychotic. Now, I didn't know that's what I was, but it manifested itself in me that the FBI, the ATF, the CIA, and the DEA were all after me. And it was a bad deal. And I walked around for 6 days feeling that people were listening into my conversations, reading my thoughts, and following me. I mean, I've listened to Sally's and Alcoholics Anonymous talk about paranoia where they're peeking through the blinds thinking the cops are looking in. No, that's not paranoia. Paranoid's going to a football stadium with 70,000 of your closest friends and thinking they're talking about you in the huddle. That's paranoia. And that's the kind of stuff that was going on in my head. It was so consuming, and this was just eating me up. And I'm divulging secrets that I wasn't going to tell anybody. Trying to get this paranoia to go away, and it just won't alleviate. It just won't let go. And I'm sitting at my brother's house, who's 7.5 years sober and Alcoholics Anonymous at the time, and he knows something's going on. He knows something's up, but he can't do anything about it. All he can do is turn the screws of pressure. He just keeps turning the screws of pressure. You got to go back to Nashville. You got to go back to Nashville. And my mind said, if I go, I'm going to go to jail. And I'm deathly afraid of going to jail. I got to turn myself in. Then I got to become a narc. And the honor among thieves of my life won't allow me to do that. And I'm in a pickle. Finally, I'm out of airspeed, altitude, and ideas. And I finally said to him, I said, Rob, I'm an alcoholic, and I don't know what to do about it as a last-ditch effort to relieve that paranoid feeling that was killing me. And he looked at me and he said, you just took the first step. I can assure you I did not take the first step. The first step's on page 30 in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. It says we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we are alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. I didn't do that. What I did was utter some words that set up a series of events that led me to you. I ended up in Mercy Center Hospital the next morning in the addictions treatment program. I went to the first day of treatment meetings, and they realized that I had a problem other than alcohol, that I had a mental psychosis that needed to be treated in the psych ward, and they put me in the psych ward. And I couldn't get out. I was locked up. I couldn't even get a white pass to go out and smoke. I could only smoke like 10 minutes out of every hour. It was awful. You know, you're in a mental institution. I don't know if anybody's been in a mental institution, but there's like a little room that's like a quarter of this room, and you get to smoke in there 10 minutes every hour. Now, you get 15 crazy people in a 7x7 room for 10 minutes of smoking, it's fun. Oh, man, it's fun, I can tell you. I mean, it is a cloud of smoke. I mean, you smoke about 6 cigarettes in 10 minutes, all 15 of you. I mean, it's amazing what can happen in there. But, I mean, I'm doing the Thorazine shuffle up and down the hall. I got the padded socks and the paper robe. I'm going to occupational therapy. You know, I'm sewing a wallet and I'm making an ashtray. And I'm psychotic, and I'm believing that I'm going to be an undercover agent. That's my psychosis. I'm turning myself in to go undercover. I am going to go undercover. I am going to live a life of excitement. I know my alcoholism fed that delusion because I get to drink, I get to do drugs, I get to do all this stuff and get paid a lot of money and get accolades and excitement, and I get to keep doing what I'm doing. And now it's going to be no problem. That was the way it was in my world. And it was absolutely real as I'm standing here today. absolutely as real as I'm standing before you today. 23 days into the psychosis, 15 days into the hospital, for whatever reason, the psychosis broke as quick as it came. I went into treatment. I had one last little shebang that first weekend before I started treatment. Failed DUA when I came back into the hospital, and they questioned me about it. I did what any good alcoholic does when they get caught at something. Lie. I just lied. You know, it was just one last time. You know, I lied about it. Man from Alcoholics Anonymous came on Tuesday night. He saved my life. Daryl Maxey from Alcoholics Anonymous came to that treatment center on Tuesday night. He was 8 years sober, and he'd been in that treatment center 8 years before, and he talked about how miserable, lost, lonely, frustrated, tired, and alone he was when he sat in that room 8 years before. And he'd been reading my mail and eating my lunch, and I don't understand how he knew those things about me, because I'd never met that man before. He afforded me the opportunity that I believe every alcoholic has to be afforded in order to get and stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous through his shared experience, strength, and hope. The language of the heart. He afforded me the opportunity to identify. Because if I can't identify with you, there's no way I can take what you offer me. Because if I'm not like you, what you offer me is not available. I have to be like you in order to take what you offer. I have to assimilate into Alcoholics Anonymous. So he afforded me the opportunity to identify. Now, I wasn't 100% sure at this point, but I went home the next night, thought about the story that I had to tell to get away with that one last time as they're turning the screws of pressure on me in the treatment center. And I have the awakening, if you will, the awareness. The mirror was held in front of my face as I was trying to come up with the con game in order to get away with it one last time. It was as if it was it was almost as though there was a voice saying, "Why are you wanting to get away with it? Let it go. Stop the lying. Own up to where you are." And I saw my life for what it really was, which was nothing but a scam. I mean, it was like an act all the way around, and I didn't like what I saw. And I sat up in my bed that morning at about 4:45 in the morning, having been tossing and turning all night, trying to figure out the story, and I saw this truth. And I physically sat up in my bed, threw my hands up in the air, and I said, "God, please help me. I don't want to live like this anymore." I didn't say, "God, please help me not to drink." I didn't even know that I had a living problem. See, alcoholism for me and my awareness and understanding of it has nothing to do with a drinking problem. Problem drinkers can stop drinking. People with drinking problems can stop drinking and their problems go away. The book talks about the heavy drinker. That's a drinking problem. Alcoholics stop drinking and their lives get worse. At least in my case, it did. See, if I don't have a solution to my living problem, which alcohol was, I can't cope with life in the world around me. I had to find a suitable substitute in order to deal with the pain of living. Alcoholics Anonymous eases the pain of living on a much more consistent, a much more fulfilling, and a much more peaceful fashion than alcohol ever eased that pain. Because the pain came back the next morning and then some every day when I was drinking. So I went in and I told my counselor the truth. She ran out from behind her desk and she hugged me. And I felt like what it felt like to be honest for the first time in so long. And it felt amazing. And it lit me on fire. That feeling lit me on fire. And I became the treatment guy. I did everything they asked me to do. I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous 2 nights later on a Friday night after treatment was over. I went to the Fox Valley Fellowship Center on 219 East Galena Avenue in Aurora, Illinois. And holy cow, that guy Daryl from Tuesday was right up there at the head of the table. And I ran in there and I asked him to be my sponsor because that's what they were telling me to do. First meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I asked that man to be my sponsor. He said, "Let's talk after the meeting." And in that meeting, I cried like an idiot for the whole night. I mean, I was ugly crying, you know, like snot bubbles and things just not good, you know. That that kind, that was me. And it was just awful, and I didn't care. After the meeting, Daryl came down. He says, "How does it feel to cry in front of all those folks?" I said, "I don't care." And he said, "Good, let's go upstairs and talk." And we sat down and we had the talk, the sponsorship talk. And if you have a sponsor and they haven't talked to you about what being a sponsor is, what being a sponsee is, what Alcoholics Anonymous is and is not, and set the terms to that relationship, I would question the effectiveness of that sponsorship relationship. Because what happens in that process, the principle that I believe is paramount in sponsorship is accountability. And the conversation was setting the terms of accountability. And he sealed the deal by asking me a final question, and that question was, are you willing to go to any length for victory over alcohol? And for lack of a better answer, I said yes. I thought that's what he wanted to hear, so I told him yes. He said, okay, what are you doing tomorrow? I said, well, you know, I'm off treatment. It's Saturday morning. I got to, you know, do a little laundry, watch a little TV, take a break. I got to go back to treatment on Monday. I got the weekend off. He said, I don't think so. He said, you will set your alarm for 5:30 in the morning, and you will get up and report to Cool Acres Park. Our annual fellowship pig roast is tomorrow, and you'll ask Rick what you can do to help. I didn't know you could change sponsors. I didn't know you could say no. And I'm thankful that God blessed me with that ignorance, because I did what that man asked me to do. And I can assure you it was the best gift I've ever been given in the entirety of my life, because when I did what he asked me to do, I went and I asked what I could do to help. And they asked me to skewer the pig, and I did that. Then they asked me to boil corn, and I did that. And they asked me to stand in the food line and serve that corn to those people as they came through for their lunch. And I stood behind that food line with a pair of paper gloves on, and I dipped corn into a vat of butter, and I put it on their plates. And I was in the middle, being of service before I knew what service was. And Janet, and John, and Ken, and Daryl, and Susan, and Larry, and all these people, they remembered my name. They said, Doug, it's good to see you. We're glad you're here. Keep coming back. They extended the hand of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous to me. But the gift I got, the gift of service. See, by being of service, what happened? The barrier that is alcoholic self-centered isolation was lowered enough that I could accept the gift of God's grace that was extended to me by that fellowship. And I accepted it. And I got to work in Alcoholics Anonymous with that sponsor. And my life's been forever changed. I did the step work. I did what I was supposed to do. I went to meetings all the time. I went to meetings every day for probably two years plus. All the time. I remember the first night I missed a meeting, it was to go play softball with my two older brothers in a league. I felt guilty about missing that meeting. It was probably 18 months sober. God, I've been served well by that time I spent early in sobriety in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I showed up early, and I sat and I listened to those old-timers tell stories about what it was like. And then I went out to dinner afterwards, and I sat in that coffee shop, and I was spoon-fed Alcoholics Anonymous with the love, tenderness, and care that only a group of individuals collectively sharing can do. See, the meetings were great, yes. I got a lot of information. But I can tell you, I was fed Alcoholics Anonymous at the dinner table after the meeting, or at the meeting before the meeting at the coffee pot, because those people demonstrated their care for me. They opened their lives and their hearts to me. Powerful, powerful process. I'll be forever grateful for it. 2 years sober, I'd met a gal. I'm living in the Chicago area where I sobered up, and I met this gal in Dallas. We were working together and talking and communicating, and I decided, you know what, I want to see where this will go. So I decided 2 years, 2 months, and 2 weeks sober to move down to Dallas, Texas. Now, at 2 years, 2 months, and 2 weeks sober, you are a guru of all things in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know all there is to know about AA. You know everything you need to do in AA. You know how to live sober. You know how to be sober. You know how to do sober. You know how to be an example of sober. All of these things. And I had all that going for me. I got down to Dallas, Texas. I got an idiot for a sponsor as soon as I arrived. God, that guy was an idiot. He was no objectivity, no honest input, no accountability, no good direction, nothing. Just literally a piss poor, terrible sponsor. And I can tell you, you are looking at that guy right now. Alcoholism, ISM, I sponsor myself. And if you sponsor yourself, I'm going to tell you, you're an idiot. You're a flat-out idiot in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if that hurts your feelings, I don't give a damn, because it's true. And if you disagree with it, why don't you try getting a sponsor and do what they ask you to do and follow their leadership and see how your life will change. Because those that do it alone are people that I wouldn't wish for their sobriety for any or all the money in the world. Because they're miserable, my observation, many, many times. Are there a few exceptions and outliers? Sure. But I can tell you this, the quantity and the statistics validate what I'm experienced in, and that is, I sponsor myself is idiocy. I'm sponsored by someone, fulfillment. Because in my life, if I don't have accountability, I cannot be successful. See, the accountability of Alcoholics Anonymous and sponsoring the 12 steps really afforded me the opportunity to walk around cleverly disguised as a normal human being. Now, I can assure you, I am by far normal. I'm by far from normal. But nonetheless, most people don't know, you know, unless I divulge my anonymity to them. So I got down to Texas about 10 months in. I'm basically headed towards picking up a drink, being sponsored by myself. I'm getting resentful. I'm getting dishonest. I'm getting manipulative. I'm getting afraid. I'm about to lose my job. I'd already lost the relationship. And I'm about to head it towards the liquor store. I'm ready to start moving towards picking up a drink. And something struck me. I became willing to be willing one more time. And I started showing up early. And I started staying late. And I started going to the coffee shop. And I met a big 6'5", about 270-pound Texan by the name of Stuart Reeves. And I started going to meetings. He said, hey, you know what? There's an assembly this weekend. I didn't have anything going on in my life. He said, you want to go? I said, sure. He's told me since that, you know what? You just struck me as a guy that wanted to do stuff like I do. And I went. In the parking lot that Saturday night, as I walked out to the car to get his book with him, I said, you know, I've been thinking about asking you a question. I've been thinking about asking you to sponsor me. And he just stopped. He turned around. He looked down at me. He said, thinking about it, huh? He said, you got a question you'd like to ask me? And I was like, Stuart, would you be my sponsor? And he set the terms, and he asked me the question, are you willing to go to any lengths for victory over alcohol? And over the last 18 years, my life has been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence that is beyond my understanding. As a result of walking day by day on the path of spiritual progress, as our book talks about, with my hand and my sponsor's hand and my hand and the guys that I sponsor's hands doing the deal of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I took service commitments and started going to jails and carried meetings to prisons for many, many years and really got fulfillment out of that. I started serving coffee at the Northeast Texas Area Assembly. A man we're going to see tomorrow asked me to do that. He walked me into the service in Alcoholics Anonymous, our third legacy. And I started out serving coffee and then became a convention chair. And while I was serving coffee, I met this little GSR from one of the neighboring groups. I kind of thought she was cute, you know. So I started flirting with her and talking to her. You know, and she's 10 years more sober than I am. And we start flirting. I don't know how to date. I never got really good at dating, you know. I didn't really do it well. I took hostages, you know, captives. I became hostages, you know, whatever. I'd volunteer for the duty. But I didn't know how to date, you know. So I'm poking her, you know, and pulling her hair and trying to trip her as we're walking. You know, that's how I flirt, you know. I'm socially retarded, basically, you know, and that's the truth. But obviously the horns in my head fit the holes in her head because we're married today, you know. She liked it, I liked it, and we started talking, and she asked her sponsor, and her sponsor gave her some ridiculous direction about dating, and that was no sex for 6 months. And she said, you don't understand what that means. That means no holding hands, no touching, no rubbing, no feeling, no nothing. The only contact can be a hug before or after a meeting, and no, you cannot change home groups. And so we went on this process of communication, and we learned how to communicate. We learned everything there was to know about each other in a course of 4.5 months. And I can tell you I'm still married to that woman today as a result of following through with that exercise. You know, I sponsor a guy down in Dallas that's actually gone through that same exercise, begrudgingly so. And I can tell you, he and his girlfriend are thankful that even though kicking and screaming, they did it because they know each other. They learn how to talk through the life circumstances that present themselves, and they come. Tracy and I got married. I married into a ready-made family. I had a 10-year-old. He was 11 when we got married. You know, we started rocking the role of boy meets girl on AA campus, and everything's good. 2 years into our marriage, things started going a little bit different, you know. Her dad fell off the roof of his house and became a brain injury patient. Our son turned 13 and started his road towards us. And we were basically tending to the things outside of our marriage that were tending rather than tending to our marriage. And we slowly started moving apart because we were being parents to the child and being children to the parents and being of service, but we weren't fulfilling the relationship necessities. And we slowly started moving apart. We were trying to get pregnant at the same time, and it didn't happen. As the youngest, I was always felt jilted that I didn't have a younger sibling. And I was always told you'd be a great dad, and I thought I had every right to have my own child of my own blood from the fresh start. And it wouldn't happen. It didn't happen. We tried artificial insemination. It didn't take. And when that happened, I got resentful at God, and I didn't even know it. And as a result of being resentful at the source of my power, what happened? That resentment invaded every area of my life. And what I did was bring out my big chief tablet and start keeping score on everything. And nobody measures up when I got the scorecard. Nobody measures up. You always get ticks in the negative. I always get ticks in the positive, and it's always out of balance. And I slowly, emotionally started to remove myself from my marriage. We got pregnant. Rachel Elizabeth Mefford was born on December 18, 2004, and it was just a glorious occasion. And on February 10th, 2005, I left my wife saying, I can't do this anymore. See, God gave me exactly what I wanted. He knew the desires of my heart, and he delivered them to me. But the reality is I had a timeline. I had a timetable, and I wasn't willing to be patient and surrender to what God had in store for me. See, we talk about surrender. We talk about surrender at depth. We talk about turning our will and our lives over to the care of God. We talk about surrender in 6 and 7, of being humbled in front of God and being allowing Him to direct us and take us to where He would have us be. I hadn't done that completely. I only thought I had. 6 months I was separated from my wife, and I did work. Did a lot of work with a counselor. Did a lot of work with a sponsor. I filed for divorce. I was done. And we had a service commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous to serve the Texas State Convention and run hospitality together. We were separated, divorce pending. We served Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a lot of people in the AA community in Dallas-Fort Worth that knew us, very active in our community in Alcoholics Anonymous. There was many people at that hospitality suite that we served that didn't even know we were separated. See, because principles in Alcoholics Anonymous work in good times and bad. We didn't trash each other in public. We didn't trash each other in AA. Most of the time, two AA members that share a home group, they break up. Whoever gets to the home group first wins. It's kind of how it is, you know. But the reality is, it's not how it has to be. Because we brought our problems to our sponsors. We brought solutions to Alcoholics Anonymous. We walked with dignity and grace and principle through that process. And as a result of doing that, both together, independently, in the community and everything, we were afforded the opportunity to put our marriage back together, and we did. Because I sensed a familiar comfort being of service to Alcoholics Anonymous I had otherwise not felt for a long period of time. I ended up going back home the next week. Our son was in jail. It was difficult. He got out of jail, went to treatment, came home, smoking methamphetamine about 6 feet from the crib that my infant daughter's in. He's got to go again. He's living on the streets. He's breaking into our house at night and robbing us. He's making it very unsafe for my wife and my daughter and I. We basically forbid him from coming in the house. We change the locks. We put new locks on the doors, this, that, and the other. And it's tough because as the father, I was done before my wife was. And I can remember the day she got done. We were back together. We're out on the golf course. We had the doggy door sealed up with 3/4-inch plywood because he was breaking in through the doggy door. So we sealed it up. Come back from the golf course. He kicked in that door with some sort of pro-bar and hammer and came in and stole a bunch of stuff. And I called her and I said, I'm calling the cops. I'm done with this. We ain't doing this anymore. And she said, absolutely, call him. I'll be there when I get home. She was going to pick up her daughter. She was done. We stood united in that process of watching our son basically go down the path towards death and alcohol in active addiction. It's a tough, tough deal. He ended up getting arrested. He ended up getting sober. I remember standing at the podium at the Irving Spring Conference as the hometown speaker on a Friday night. And I'm standing up there talking. And I'm talking, and my wife's there and my daughter's there. My son, 20 months clean in NA. His girlfriend, the mother of my granddaughter, and my granddaughter are all right there, and all's right in the world. Man, it was just an amazing experience. It was like, all is right with the world. 3 weeks later, they decide they'd never had a drink legally in a bar, and they leave the baby in the bed, and they go to the bar and have a drink. We got to take that baby in. We got to take her away from her parents because she doesn't have a voice. See, alcoholism and drug addiction is the only power I know stronger than the power of a mother's love for a child. And the only power I know that's stronger than that is Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 steps to overcome that difficulty. So we took that child in. They ended up going to jail. My son ended up in prison. No longer jail, no longer county. He went to the big boy prison. It was a tough deal to watch. You know, there's the most selfish statement that I believe any alcoholic can make is, I'm only hurting myself. And until you've been directly affected by somebody's alcoholism, you have no idea the impact it can have. It's heartbreaking. It's gut-wrenching. And I remember talking to Alcoholics Anonymous, what was going on at that point or whatever, and I'd stand there and in the thank you line, people would come up and say, he's going to be okay. He's going to be okay. He's going to be okay. And I knew he was at some point. I just didn't know if it was going to be on this earth or not. See, alcoholism and drug addiction kills people. I don't ever want to lose sight of that. I don't ever want to forget that. Fortunately, he ended up getting okay. And he's doing pretty good now. He's got a job, and he's bought a house, and he's married, and he's got another kid on the way. And, you know, things are pretty good. But you know what? You never know. There's no guarantees for me. There's no guarantees for him. When I was down at the San Antonio International in 2010, I'm standing outside that room, the convention center after the big meeting, over the footbridge. Those that were there, you walk over this footbridge, you go into the convention center and go through. I'm standing there smoking a cigarette with my wife, and this little man from India comes up. His name's Lalu. He comes walking up and says hello. We start to talk. We exchange numbers. The Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous got a little broader. here he goes at the end of this. I own coffee plantations at the end of this conversation. He says, if you ever come to India, I'd love to host you at my coffee plantation. And my response to that was, okay, that'd be great. India? Come on. Never. He calls every 3 or 4 months. We talk. I get laid off in the oil field. I come to work in Atlanta. The first job, one of the first questions my boss says, if we hire you, are you willing to go to India? I said, yeah, I am. I went home. I had to start packing because I had to go to work. I couldn't find Lalu's number, and I hadn't talked to him about 3 months. Friday, January 2nd, 2013. I'm getting ready to leave Saturday morning. The phone rings Friday night. Who was it? It was Lalu. And I exchanged information with him. The following September, I went to Bangalore, India. It's where he has a city house, where his kids go to school. Plantation is in Chikmangalore, about 6 hours southeast of there. I get to meet up with him, and I go to some meetings in India. And then he hosts me at his coffee plantation for a 3-day weekend just 2 years ago now. I sat on the top of a mountain in southeast India, the pitch black of night, the man with 14 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous in India, and two neighboring plantation workers, each with 90 days, got in the back of that Jeep and we had an AA meeting there. And God doesn't know what he's doing. God doesn't know just what he's doing. See, if I'm willing to surrender and accept what God has in store for me, I have no idea how he's laid the cards out for my deck. It's foolish for me to think that I know what his plan is. It's foolish for me to think that I know where I'm going. It's foolish of me to think that I know what's best for me. Because I can assure you I had no desire to come to Atlanta, Georgia and live. I was ingrained and rooted in Dallas, Texas. But when God opens the door and I have a willingness to walk through, amazing things are coming to pass. I went back. I got to give that man his 15-year chip a year later. I got to have dinner with his wife and his two children, and we were making plans. I had booked his hotel reservation for him to come and be in Atlanta. He was going to come to my home, and I was going to host him and serve he and his wife a meal in my house. And I came to find out on May 2nd he died in a car accident, and it ripped my heart out. See, when I build relationships and I engage in people's lives and they go away, it's dreadfully difficult. But you know what? I can be fearful and afraid to risk and open myself and have the experiences that God has in store for me. And I can be withdrawn and withheld and be alone. Or I can open myself up to what he has in store and accept what he offers and engage with it wholeheartedly and enjoy the blessings and the richness of those relationships. And when they go away, I can be grateful for having had them. In April, a year and a half ago, I was set to go to Disney World. My mom had an angiogram and found out that she had 100% blockage and 90% blockage in a couple of arteries and was going to have some surgery. And instead of going to Disney World with my wife and daughter, I went up there to their house in Hot Springs Village, Arkansas. My mom was an Al-Anon, and she and I built a great, wonderful adult relationship as a result of the fellowships of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. So we both went to the same clubhouse, and she went to her room, and I went to my room when we were both new in recovery. We went to dinner at least once a week, and we shared friends, and we shared experiences, and we came to love one another at a depth that I didn't know was possible with my mom, because she was the one I hated. She was the one that questioned me, and I hated her for it. And I remember when I got to make amends to her and sit down and say, you know the things that I did to you, Mom, and these things and those things and this thing and that thing with specificity and generality? I got to say to her, you know, I did those things not because I didn't want. I wanted to hurt you. I did those things because I wanted you to leave me alone. And I know I hurt you, but that was not my objective, and I hope you understand that. And I got to give her a little bit of freedom that came as a result of doing that. And our relationship grew. But anyway, I'm up there, and she says to me as I come into the house that night, she says, you know, I'd have never asked you to not go to the most magical place on earth, Disney World. But I'm sure glad you did. I got to make the bed with my mom and visit with her. I got to lay down and sleep that night and get up the next morning and help prep her to take her to the hospital. We got to go to the hospital and get checked in. And I got to sit with my dad and my sister as she went through surgery, get hourly updates. It's going well, it's going well, it's going well, until it's not. They put us into a locked room. The head nurse comes up and says, we're having some trouble. We don't know what's going to happen. I walk out of that room when she does, and I call my sponsor. When you establish habits, when problems come, there's no question. And he told me what he expected of me. and he held me accountable, regardless of the circumstances, that I was there to be a servant of God to my father and my sister and whatever was assigned. And he would be there for me to lean on. I walked back in the room and the head surgeon came in and said, "We lost her." And my sister crumbled and my dad crumbled. See, I'm an alcoholic that can make everything about me. No matter what happens with those around me, I can turn it around and say, how's that going to affect me? I do that. I can still do that. How's that going to impact me? And in the moment probably that would have the greatest impact on me as a human being, the loss of my mother, I didn't have that thought, not once. You tell me God's not powerful? I don't buy it. Because God gave me that gift of freedom from that self in order to be of service and hold up my dad, my sister. You know, my mom and I were current. It was a tough, tough, difficult circumstance to go through. But I'm grateful that y'all gave me the opportunity and the tools to go through it with a measure of dignity and grace in a servant's heart. Because of my own accord, I can't do those things. Of my own accord, I'm not capable. Of my own accord, I don't even want to. But man, how grateful I am. We did the funeral arrangements, and 4 days later, we had her funeral. There was 8 members of Alcoholics Anonymous from 4 states that I am directly related to in sponsorship one way or another that came to support me. And I don't know if they'll ever understand how much that meant. The lives that I'm afforded, the lives that we are afforded to impact and affect in here is just unbelievable. And if you don't believe it, get in all the way in. As a friend of mine in East Texas says, get all the way in, sit all the way down, and stay. Engage fully in the process of recovery. Sponsor people. Have a sponsor, use a sponsor, be a sponsor, and stay committed, and remarkable things will come to pass. I thank God every day for Alcoholics Anonymous and the life it has afforded me, because without Alcoholics Anonymous, I would not know that God. So I thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to have the life that I've been afforded. I don't always know the differentiation between God's will and what is and what's my will versus what's God's will. But I believe what pleases God in my life is when I do what I believe he wants me to do. And what my God, the gracious and loving gentleman that he is, wants me to do is to make him my first choice rather than my last resort. And if I do that, I believe it pleases him. And I can tell you for sure, if I do that, my life is better for it. Thanks for letting me be here.